It's Wednesday, May 15th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 298 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Pat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What?
Did you forget Johan wasn't here?
For some reason.
That's what I did.
For some reason, I was thinking, Chris went next. And I'm like, damn it.
Wow.
That's awesome. Hi, I'm Chad. Do-do-do.
Yeah, and I'm Chris.
You're going to cut all that out, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's going to be really easy to clean up. There's good breaks in there and everything.
Just wait for the dirt and then cut there.
That would be awesome. That's always
I'll not start even, the episode yeah, there.
Dirt
Yeah, forget the hi-hat. That's the new thing.
I just had this you know, the type of person I am, if someone else had done that, I would cut the dirr out, and I would use that as the sound effect for the text messages.
I'm just thinking how to start the episode there. Just start it on that.
I think that's appropriate.
I think it is absolutely
appropriate. I was going to do this great thing, this callback to Wayne.
Oh, you did know, this great thing.
Because how, like, Wayne always goes, still Wayne, after he does the third take. I was going to do still Chan. I was thinking about it. It's like, that's going to be a great callback. And I'm like, I just have to go after Chris. And it's like, crickets. It's like, gah.
You realize what you just described there is you are planning yourself toward Wayne's life decisions.
Yes.
You understand what kind of a dark hole that
that's
is.
True.
Oh, yes.
You do realize what you're doing.
Saying I am going to sit down and consciously attempt to emulate
Wayne's
life decisions.
That's right. Wayne is a great man.
Right.
He's a great
Wayne man. Is a great epic. Man. I like Wayne.
He is. He's cuddly. He's fresh. He smells nice, too.
Also gingery.
Especially when he sleeps.
He doesn't like it when I watch him sleep.
That's because you run your hands through his hair while he's trying to sleep.
Yeah.
Haven't done that.
Yet. Anyway, so Chris, you've got a dumb and irrelevant story you want to tell.
I do. I have a completely another boring tale
breath
from Chris. So by all means,
baited.
Go get your yes, go get your snacks and don't pay attention in the next 5 minutes.
Holler at me. I'll be.
No, this is one of those kinds of stories where it all had to do with timing, and the timing was completely by accident. Quick geography. I live in Waterloo, Iowa, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is a much larger metro area, is about 45 minutes south of me.
12 people.
I don't.
Yes.
As opposed to
that's
five.
When college is in, in session.
Anyway, so I'm down in Cedar Rapids, and I'm distributing Fear the Con flyers, like a good little co-host that I am.
This does explain something, because I guess since I'm not from the hood, I just don't know all your lingo. The way you describe the story in the forum is like, so I was in the CR, and I'm like, what the hell is he? I don't even know what anything is.
CR.
Wow.
CR. I was in the Sizzy, and...
I couldn't figure out what CR was. I thought this was supposed to be a game store or something. I didn't realize it was Cedar Rapids.
You know what I hate?
Or Corn Repository. I mean, you know, it is Iowa.
I hate it when...
Actually, they do refer to Waterloo a lot of times as the Lou.
See, people do that with St. Louis. I hate that. It's like, hey, let's go down to the Lou. It's
yes,
like,
because
what, you
know what, you
gotta go to the bathroom?
I was going to say, when you're talking to someone from, say, London, and you talk about going to the Lou, that's not a positive... Yeah. Well, it is to them. I mean, because, you know, they have to go to the bathroom. So I guess that is a positive thing.
Sure.
But if you were to come to the Loo here, you'd have mountains in the background.
If you came to the Loo here, you would see basically the infinite horizon as it's incredibly flat around here. So at any rate, so I'm down in Cedar Rapids distributing Fear the Con flyers. I'm down in the CR.
Yes, we've established this.
And I was stopping at this game store I had never been to. It's called Tempest Games. And first of all, I go in there and it's just packed with people. They must have been running like a magic tournament. So I immediately walk in there. And first of all, I'm very, very happy to see that it's a very, very full game store.
Down the CR hanging at Temmie G.
But
I mean, that's
It had that. First of all, it was also just a sea of black as well. And as far as the shirts everybody was wearing, not only was a sea of black people.
Carry on, Chris.
Am I doing just fine?
You're doing just fine. You're doing just fine.
Pat's infectious. Carry on. So, not that there's anything wrong with that. So anyway, so I walk into Tempest Games, game store I'd never been to, sea of black t-shirts, and it has that immediate gamer funk, not the BO, but just kind of that the AC can't keep up with it kind of, you know, scent in the atmosphere. But the game store itself, gorgeous place.
Chris, you just went through, they had this gamer funk. It's not BO, it's not, but
no,
it's BO.
Because it doesn't.
And all you did, and you blamed it on the AC.
I blamed it on the alcohol. No, it wasn't smelly, but it was that heavier, warm air. So you know what I mean?
Earthy.
Yeah, earthy. Yeah. It's that.
Right.
Okay, so anyway.
It's gamer musk.
So I go up to the counter, and I have to stand in line. There's this guy with his wife and kid standing in front of me, and they're like actually purchasing some game product. So I'm just kind of standing there, hanging there with my flyers, not wearing anything that identifies who I am, who I'm affiliated with, anything like that at all. So for some reason, the guy behind the counter says, I'm going to take care of you in a second, but I want to take care of this guy, and he's pointing at me. So he like suspends that transaction or something. He calls me forward, and I walk up, and I hold the flyers on. I said, you take con flyers. I said, we got a con coming up here in a few weeks, and can you put these on the counter or whatever? And he kind of looks at it a little bit, and he says, oh, sure, no problem. And then out of the blue, the guy who I basically displaced, the guy who was there with his wife and his kid, he looks at me and he says,
you motherfucker.
And then he punches me right in the nuts. No, he looks at
wow. He must have been short.
He was a Rifts player. So, no, he.
His last name was Lannister. It's, I don't know.
He looks at me and out of the blue, he says, hey, I just want to let you know, I absolutely love the podcast. You guys are great. You guys do a great show. Completely catches me off guard. And so, I,
and then you give him the $5 you owe
him. I turn and I look at him and I give him a big old noble bear hug. And no, I start talking to him and, you know, thanked him very much for all that and asked, you know, oh yeah, he listens and everything. And then he says to me, and he says, and last year, by the way, went to Fear the Con, had a great time. Being a podcast listener and finding you in a random encounter this way is one thing, but having him actually gone to Fear the Con, which isn't even a smaller circle of people, just completely blew my mind. He's like, oh yeah, me and my son went, and it was great. We just had a fantastic time. It was, and we started talking about the con last year, so I knew he wasn't bullshitting me because he was like remembering all of these various details about it.
People lie to us about that all the time.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's a common occurrence. But he his son says, yeah, I played D&D for the very first time at Fear the Con 5. And I asked him, I said, well, do you remember who your DM was? And he didn't, but he said, yeah. He said it was great. It was just wonderful. And so we were talking about this year's Fear the Con, and he couldn't go for various reasons. But we like had like this five-minute conversation, which, you know, occurred basically out of nowhere. And his name, I believe, was Robert. His son's name was Andrew, and they listen to the podcast. They live in Vinton, Iowa, which is really small town.
Check the show notes for their address and phone number.
Yes, and then I'll also snapped a
social security number.
I snapped a couple of pictures so you can bust into their house. But yeah, so we had this great conversation, and he was a very, very happy listener. And I excused myself once we were done talking. You know, it got to that point, and I wanted to look around the store a little bit. Plus, I had to get going. So. But it was just so random and so just unexpected. But it was fantastic to, A, not only run into a listener, but then, B, he'd been to Fear the Con, which was just phenomenal in and of itself. So it was very cool.
In the CR.
In the CR, of all places, a place where I don't even really go to very much. So
yeah, it's a conundrum.
Is it serendipity? Would that be the right word? I don't know.
Serendipitous, yes.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So our topic for today is one that we set up in the prior episode, but this episode, we're actually come back and hit it.
That one that I was on?
Yeah, you were on that one.
I wasn't.
I've done like two episodes of Kicked in the Dice Bags, one of them with you, and Fear the Boot, and I'm just all over
the place. Yeah, I know. And you're a podcast whore.
Well, apparently one of them was on 5 hours.
Oh my God.
It was a 5 hour long conversation, and there was like, I think it was like 2 to 3 hours of podcast got pulled out of that.
Jeez.
Fear the Boot will not do that to you. I don't know, some people like that. I don't know. So anyway, what we set up last time is talking about the scale of games. And the little subtopic we dealt with in the prior episode was dealing with scale of combat. So there's a mass combat going on, but you want your players to have some kind of a meaningful tale or meaningful role within that combat. And how do you bring that out? What are some approaches for bringing that out? But this is actually a subtopic of a broader topic that we were looking at, which is the scale of the game in general. And what got me thinking about this is I was running two games in parallel. Both of them were Apocryphos games. In one game, the party was a group of soldiers that was dealing with the potential of an interspecies war.
amongst several of the major players in the galaxy, so it wasn't going to be quite a galaxy-wide war, but this was still going to be a really damn big conflict. In the other one, what the group is playing is a bunch of investigators. And I don't mean investigators that are, like, trying to find spies or anything like that. The way the setting works, medical technology has advanced to the point that death very rarely happens. So what most governments have done is they've looked at what's left of a person, and based on what they can reconstitute, say, okay, on these thresholds, it's going to be the same person with some lost memories or changed personalities, or it might as well be a clone, so we're going to call them dead and you have to dispose of the body. So when this occurs, usually the courts are able to sort out pretty quickly, look, this person's way on one side, way on the other. They make ruling, and it's pretty much irrevocable. But you get these handful of cases where they really are arguably on the borderline, or maybe they're not arguably on the borderline, but there's some compelling public interest by which they need to be brought back because they know something really important, or they were somebody really important, or maybe there's just corruption involved and money getting passed around. And that's what these people do, is they go in, find some person who died, and they try to decide whether this person ought to be revived or ought to be simply taken out of the freezer and allowed to die, which is really the state they were in anyway if medicine had not been capable of sustaining them like that. All right, so here's the point, though. One game takes place at a very, very small scale. It is really stories about people, and they might be doing interesting and unusual things, but what they're dealing with is really just like a family and the community and the handful of events that might surround these individual deaths and what makes them arguable cases that ultimately they have to make the moral decision of, we're going to let this person live or we're going to let this person die. The other group was dealing with these things of galactic intrigue and wars where billions of individuals on both sides or every side could have been killed. And these are very, very different kinds of stories. And if you look at role-playing games in general, it seems that most role-playing games that I've encountered, at least, I mean, not that I've done like a survey on this, but at least the ones I encounter, seem to prefer telling epic stories. And I have noticed as a game master that one of the things that I often feel compelled to do when I'm sitting down and writing a plot is I feel this compulsion to make the story epic because of the fact that if it's not big, then maybe it's not interesting or maybe it's not important. But while I do that subconsciously, the conscious part of my mind, as I kind of think through that, is like, no, that's wrong. That's not true. There's nothing wrong with telling an epic story, but you can tell incredibly interesting stories that are not on an epic scale. You know, every person listening to this has at least some interesting anecdotes from their life. Depending on what you do, maybe you have a lot. And yet I would wager that most of us live relatively quiet and anonymous lives. We're not out there saving the galaxy. We're not out there killing dragons. We're not saving the princess. We're not doing any of these huge things. And yet that doesn't change how interesting or compelling our lives can be. Now, what do you guys think about that in terms of a role-playing game?
I blame Star Wars. You know, I think what you say about the subconscious wanting to tell an epic tale, I think that there's a lot of, you know, whether it's, you know, covert or overt influence from, you know, outside media. I think that the whole idea of creating this awesome world, universe changing tale, and your characters are right there in the middle of the action, they're the ones actually turning the lever to change the universe as it exists. There's a lot of appeal to that because in our regular mundane lives, we don't get to do that very often. So there's, I think, this deep-seated desire to want to try and do that on some sort of scale, to be somebody or to do something. I do completely agree with you, though. I think that you can tell fantastically wonderful stories just on that intimate scale. For example, in my current campaign world that I created actually years ago, and the very first campaign I ran in that one was of that scale. There's this one large kingdom that was threatening to break up, and there was threats of war coming from other sides, and there was a supernatural, you know, otherworldly creature involved, you know, who was like manipulating things behind the scenes, and the characters traveled halfway across the known world here in their efforts to try and, you know, quash and change this plot and eventually kind of save everything. And in the end, you know, became part of the fabric of that portion of the world. Conversely, the campaign that I'm running now with my current group, it's not like that at all. They're characters from the same town, pretty much. When everything's done with, they're going to still end up in that same town. This town is incredibly small. The threat they're dealing with is big in relation to that town, but it's still really, on a grand scale-wise, it's still pretty small. They haven't done nearly as much traveling, but yet, in a certain sense, the overall story and the interactions that are occurring between the characters and the plot and everything else and everyone that they meet, is I'm actually finding it to be a bit more interesting, and I think it's because of that smaller scale. I mean, there might be other reasons going on here, but I think there's more character development going on in this particular campaign than the other one, and I think that sense of scale has a lot to do with that.
I think what I find is that, and this is not a truism necessarily, that I'm just kind of going off my experience. On the small scale, the stories have more punch. And the reason why they do is because you can identify with them more, and they're more down to earth, and they're more on a personal, social level. But also, I think, because a really epic, spanning storyline kind of takes away some of that punch and replaces it with its epicness and spanningness. Now, that doesn't mean that it's good or bad or better or worse. It just means that, it's like you have a pie chart.
Right.
There's only so much epic you can put in there, and there's only so much punch you can put in there. There's only so much interpersonal drama you can put in there. And then it's just the sort of scales are a little bit different.
And one thing I've also found it's really hard with super epic games is they eventually get very hard to follow up on.
Yeah.
Because what makes an epic game so powerful is its epicness.
Right.
We just saved the kingdom.
What's next?
Exactly. And even if we move to another campaign, mm-hmm. well, then in this campaign, now instead of saving the kingdom, we save the Star Empire. And
yeah,
especially when you're with group.
The lens keeps pulling out. And I think that's cool.
Or even just moving. It's just,
yeah. Well,
now instead of saving the kingdom, we just go to a different setting and do something equally epic. And pretty soon, that starts to become fairly predictable. That starts to become fairly mundane. You kind of hit this point where it's like, I don't know, you see this sometimes in video games. I'm playing through Mass Effect right now, and there's one point where somebody is like, Commander Shepard, can you help me? He's like, sure, why not? Everybody else dumps their problems on me. And I don't remember what he says, but he makes some metagame comment to that effect. And it's the same kind of thing where if you sit in a role-playing group for all these years, or even look at your own career as a gamer, moving from group to group over the course of your life, if you just go from one place to the next, and your goal is to work your way up to level 20 and do something epic, and that's what you're doing in campaign after campaign after campaign, I mean, eventually, I think that loses its punch, because the fact that you just save the universe is no longer, forget the character, it's no longer significant to the player. There's no emotional buy-in at that moment anymore.
There's a difficulty in bridging story-wise from where they went to before to where they want to go now. If you remember the old Simpsons clip when they were making fun of Star Trek, and they have Kirk on there, and then he's like, oh, again with the Klingons, and to go back to my previous campaign example, when we were done, a lot of the players wanted to continue on. But one character had gone and he was, ruling his own barony. Another one had gone on to be a representative. And so they had kind of all scattered to the winds. And story-wise, it would not have made sense to, hey, let's get the band back together and go save this part of the world.
Being the emperor and go kick some orcs out of a cave.
Exactly. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, and I think that you can have an epic game. My previous comment kind of downed epic games a little bit, but I think that you can have an effective epic game, but you have to plan it out. And you have to use a sort of stepped method. And I go back to the game that we played where you played Gnarl and all that. That I had planned out to be a stepped game, stepping up in epicness. So you were starting out on the road. Some of your characters were like fallen heroes. Other ones were just starting out on their hero's journey. And, you went into a town and you got involved in the politics of the town. And eventually you took over the town and took over the castle and made it your own. Well, the next part was going to expand the lens out a bit, where it's now you have neighboring towns and castles. And then there's now because you have this castle, you're now part of a greater political, social thing.
It was like Spore, except we played it for more than 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. And then you kind of pulled out again, and then you were going to be part of this big country, and that there was going to be some stuff, as silly as it sounds, there was going to be some stuff on the moon, because you're not on Earth, and there's evil entities on the moon, and they were trying to influence things, and then you kind of get into that. But to me, and how I like it, is that it gets silly if you step it up, 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 and you either reach a plateau and then it's all sameness, or you're just going the stair step into infinity of power levels, and then it just gets silly. But what you can do, and what Chris was saying, where, you know, let's get the band back together, I agree that doesn't really make a lot of sense thematically when you're stepping up into this epic thing. But what you can do is, if you have done it if the game master has done it properly and the group has done it properly, your actions, because they're so epic and because they're so far-reaching, have changed the land fundamentally. And so if the players remember what it was like on this bottom step, then you have the second chapter of the game and you're on the bottom step again with new characters, or probably one or two of the old characters, or you're relatives of them, or you were side NPCs, or you were something that's like the next generation or whatever of the characters, and you're in this altered land, altered universe, altered whatever you're playing that has been altered significantly by the previous generation. And I think that you can go on that, and if you want to do an epic game again, you just step it up, step it up, step it up. And I think that can be really cool. I think it can also be really cool that you have this big epic game where you step it up, and then you do the chapter two, and you're back at the bottom again,
right?
But you're not doing an epic game. You're doing, like, in that universe and how everything's changed, but it's a very low-level epic game about interpersonal relationships, and you're exploring this setting.
Yeah, and made. I think that's more the point that I was trying to make. Is not that epic games in any way are inherently problematic. It's when they become the only trick you've got.
Right, right. When they replace good story.
Right. When, as a game master, every story that you're telling is another epic story. Mm-hmm. That is the only kind of story you become capable of telling. And I think, in addition to being, after a while, a little bit repetitive, I think it also, in a way, could, and doesn't have to, because these aren't mutually exclusive ideas. You can have an epic story that also tells compelling small stories, mm-hmm, along the way.
Absolutely.
But I think it, in some ways, it makes it a little bit too easy to skip over the smaller things because suddenly they're less interesting,
mm-hmm,
or it certainly could feel that way to the player characters. The example that I want to give to illustrate this is when we were kicking this around, Chris and I kind of described what it means for something to be epic in two different terms. The distinction that I saw in the way that we were describing it was Chris was talking about the scale of the events, whereas I was talking about the scale of involvement. And I think both of these sliders can be played with. You can have them both at 10, both at 1, or one at 10 and the other at 1. But by the epicness of your involvement, the examples he gave is small might be you save a village.
Mm-hmm.
You know, medium might be you save a village and then the larger group that was threatening your village. And then epic is like you save the kingdom. Well, I pointed out that there's another way to cut that, which is, let's look, for example, at the story of Anne Frank. Here is somebody where the background to...
Do you think that she's a believer?
I'm not even going there. But the background...
Pat's going to be, what, yeah, the, I'm gonna, are go, you talking about?
I'm going to go to the Anne Frank house and sign. I bet if she was alive today, she'd be a booter.
Yeah.
There you go.
Classy.
Yeah. Anyway, but no, I mean, take a look at the story of Anne Frank. Here is somebody where her journal tells the story of her living day to day and just kind of the silly little things they were doing to pass the time and the little habits that each of them had and just kind of that day to day minutia, but it's nonetheless an unbelievably powerful and fascinating story. This all takes place in what was an attic? I mean, you know, mm-hmm, it's a relatively small space, but what is the backdrop to this? The backdrop to this is the largest armed conflict in human history.
Yeah.
Where there is a regime that is out to annihilate entire races of people, and hers was first up on the chopping block. So there you're nonetheless telling a story that by one measure you could say is extremely epic because it's about this world changing event. But on the other hand, is really not epic at all because what you're looking at is the stories of one girl living in an attic who really doesn't do anything to affect the outcome of that war. Now, certainly the story that she told has had an impact on the people who have heard it, you know, through human sympathy and whatnot. It's a powerful and compelling story, but she didn't save the universe. She didn't even save herself. You know, I think that kind of points to the types of stories that we can cheat ourselves out of if, as game masters, we fall back to that one trick. If I want this game to be compelling, I'm going to do it by making it matter. And the only way I can make it matter is if billions of lives are on the line and they're in their hands. But that's not the only kind of story that works. That's not the only kind of story. And within our role-playing career, I think, once again, while admitting that I have tended toward doing this myself, I can still say that throughout the course of our gaming history, we have had stories that fell on every side of this. You know, the game with Gnarl, for example, yes, that was headed to a very large scale. Mm-hmm. Skies of Glass game wasn't necessarily headed that direction. It could have, depending on what you guys did. But for the most part, it was really about the trouble three or four teens and 20-somethings were getting into around what was left of an already small town in Missouri.
Yeah.
You guys were interacting with people that were changing the world. Mm-hmm. But you yourselves weren't doing that. You weren't playing at that level.
See, I think what I like in terms of gaming, I want my, you know, our group of characters to be certainly the center focus of the story, but I don't feel that I need the epicness of it.
Right.
Epic is fine. It can be fun, but I think that off, like what you've been saying, it can be overdone or you can get lost in it. To take your example where you're talking about Anne Frank set against the backdrop of World War II, my thing is, I think it's very hard for a lot of GMs to try to play both sides of that story of having a small scope story for the players, you know, where they're doing their more normal day-to-day things, but then in the background describing the war that's going on, because that's not what they're doing. Like, if your role-playing group was doing that, you're focused in the village at about the day-to-day life and surviving in the village. Yes, there's a war in the background, but how do you cut away and, as a GM, portray the battles that are going on, you know, the Battle of the Bulge, the this, that, or the other? It just doesn't, you know, there's no way to get into it. And so I think you can stumble on it. And I think oftentimes what happens is the GM seeing that will say, okay, well, that's hard. So I'm just going to thrust my characters into the epicness of it. And they're going to be this small group of uber heroes that save the entire allied forces.
I think there's also, you know, going to be some player impulse you're going to have to watch, and you have to make sure going into that people know the kind of story you're trying to tell.
Yeah,
because I'm sure within a lot of groups the compulsion's going to be, I'm not staying in the attic. When the Nazis come knocking, I'm going to go get a gun or go get a baseball bat or whatever. You get the point.
I'm gonna fight my way to England.
Yeah, and I'm going to go beat some ass, and I'm going to go help stir up resistance, and we're going to assassinate Adolf Hitler, or maybe, as Chris said, we're going to escape to England. But there's this desire to up the ante. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe some of that comes from what people enjoy in gaming, which is fine. I think maybe some of it comes from the fact that in a role-playing game, look, pretend life is a lot more expendable than real life. People don't often feel fear in a role-playing game when a gun is pulled on them the way that they would feel it in real life.
Blackleaf, no!
But yeah, I really enjoy...
You see if there's a Kickstarter to get a movie made for that.
Yeah. The guy says that he acquired the rights to make the movie from Jack Chick, but he offers no proof of that in the Kickstarter. So I find it dubious. Not unreasonable. He said he basically... The story is that he won $1,000 in a lottery. And then so he was like, well, what can I spend the money on? And he's like, oh, man, I could spend $1,000 and try to acquire the rights to make a Jack Chick movie. And so he goes forth and he claims that he has the rights. The problem is that Jack Chick is like this recluse and doesn't give interviews. So nobody can really
confirm this.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they can. Maybe the guy does. You know, but he doesn't offer any proof of it.
This is most Kickstarters. I figure give it a week or two.
Yeah.
And whatever he does or doesn't have, somebody's going to figure out.
If he's doing it for real, I think it's hilarious. If it's a joke, I still think it's hilarious.
If it's a scam, not so much.
Yeah, if it's a scam and he's taking money.
Yeah,
then,
well,
you
which
know,
is on he, Kickstarter, which, yeah. I mean, if it...
He can sit and spin if that's the case.
Yeah.
Right? You know.
But yeah, if it is real, I totally want to back this.
Yes.
I got to look at the back reward, see if there's something like I can get my character
in
there.
He even claimed, well, the top level backer award will allow you to make the decision, is this movie set in 2013, which is when he's making it?
Or is it set like 1983?
1982, when the chick track is. And you're going to have to link the chick track for all the two people who don't know about it.
Yeah, what that is. Yeah.
Don't link the Kickstarter. We don't know if it's a scam. Yeah, we don't want to sound like we're backing this guy. I just think it's hilarious.
Well, and yeah. I don't know. Maybe I am. I don't know. At this point, I don't know. I don't know what he intends to do with it. I don't know.
He says it's going to be low budget. It's going to be crappy. It's only going to have a couple people in it. And he said he's going to take it seriously, even though he knows it's a joke.
Right.
I think it's really funny myself.
That is hilarious.
But anyway, so yeah, the point being, though, that I think it's hard for people when they don't feel that kind of fear to keep the story at that low level. It's sometimes the impulse of the characters that they see an injustice, they see something frustrating, and rather than focusing on the story, there's this overwhelming desire to change the scenario. I mean, look, there is a trait of humanity which has been observed many times over, which is, I don't think we're completely unique in this regard. We're certainly unique in our ability to do it. But most things adapt to their surroundings. We adapt our surroundings to us. And that's not per se a statement about politics or conservation or anything like that. I think that's just the way that we are. We're wired to be that way. And once again, I don't think we're alone in that regard. We're just a hell of a lot better at it than beavers are or crows are, but they all do the same thing. We're just better at it. But the point being that nature is still going to be there when you're in a role-playing game. You're going to see a story that maybe is not supposed to be at your level. It's really just kind of part of the setting. But if the players don't understand what the story is supposed to be about, then they're going to want to thrust themselves into that. And maybe that story doesn't need to be there at all. You know, in the case of the Skies of Glass game, you guys got the inkling of some bigger plots that were going on. But the vast majority of what you were dealing with on a day-to-day basis was the survival of a small group of individuals, typically in conflict with other small groups of individuals. You weren't even really, I mean, there were a few points where you're doing something along these lines, but overall, you really weren't even saving the town that you lived in.
No, we were, you know what, we were growing as characters, and that's what I was trying to get at before. That's, to me, that's what I like in a role-playing game.
Yep.
I don't need the epic. I'll go ahead and say that. I'll be strong on that. I was going to capitulate and say, you know, the epic can be fine, but no, what, you don't need it. I am interested in role playing a group of characters that start off in whatever beginnings, be it humble or mid level or whatever, but that they have their own story. It's based around them, and they go through their growth process, and they learn new things, and they do whatever. It doesn't have to be that they're saving the kingdom. I mean, it's just about what they're doing, because this has happened to me. I've played in epic campaigns, and you just get lost in it. The epic becomes the GM's way of pontificating his story that he wants to tell. And you, as the player, you're
just passengers instead of drivers.
Yes, exactly. I don't feel like I am an active participant in this, that I am instrumental in doing this. It's that I'm along for the ride, and this is what's going to happen. I'm part of your story. But I don't feel that I had a big hand in making it come to fruition.
True. It really depends on how much freedom the GM's giving you to affect the plot. But I think the problem that I've had with games like that, and I'm not saying this is a problem with the games, this is a problem with the way that I approach those games, is I tend to lose sight of the character and become goal oriented. I am so focused on saving the kingdom or building my empire, or defeating the other baron, or whatever the issue is.
You're amassing the power, getting the gold. Yeah, absolutely.
Who I am starts to fade away.
Yes.
And this is, since we've used this game multiple times this episode and several others, we'll just keep going back to it. You know, Chad, that D&D game that you ran, there was one thing that kept that from happening. Because there were parts of that game where I became very goal-oriented, where it was really about reestablishing this Knoll group, setting up a new clan, helping to cement Pat's power base, because my character saw himself as kind of a bondservant of Pat's in this weird sort of way. But smaller stories kept coming up. Despite this huge, epic, world-rending tale that was unfolding, you still took the time to tell small stories. We were at the height of our power when Gnarl did the musical.
Yes.
Where he sang the Knoll Troll song. That was at the height of our power, where we got taken off to the side village and they were really down in the dumps about a lot of things. And we had, and indeed were working toward, the resources necessary to change their circumstance. But in the process of doing that, there was these moments where it's like, okay, some of my Null tribe was on the way over to help the situation militarily. Pat and I can't remember who else was playing at that point that had magical capacity. I think Beth was playing with us by that point. We're looking into ways of changing it magically because there's these elements of magic that were involved in what was going on with this little orphanage or town or what it was out in the middle of nowhere. But we're sitting there while we're waiting on all of that. And it's like, these people are depressed. They're demoralized. They're living in squalor and about to die. You know, and we're working to change that, but we can't change that right this second. You know, these things take time. And so there came these small stories about the way that the children were interacting with Beth's character, about the things that we were doing to try and entertain them, about the way in which Gnarl, who was this 7'6" tall, I mean, this monstrous monster, was trying to interact with these very vulnerable people in a non-threatening way, despite the fact that he wasn't completely attuned to that. You know, he didn't per se want to threaten them, but trying to be a teddy bear also wasn't necessarily at the top of his mind either. And so these little stories start coming out about the things that are happening around us. And I think if you're running an epic plot, once again, those stories are great. My only complaint with epic plots categorically is that they become the fallback de facto style of gaming. Mm-hmm. That's my only real flat complaint with them. I think if you're going to tell one, though, one of the things that you can do to keep it awesome is to remember that ultimately this is a story about the characters. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are events. Yes, those events can and should be interesting. But there's a reason we call it a role-playing game and not a plot expositioning game.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's a Absolutely. Role that I am playing. There's a character that I want to explore. You have to keep finding ways of coming back to that. Patton wasn't out leading the charge every day. He spent, well, sometimes by his own choice and sometimes not, he spent time back away from the front lines. You know, people that do epic things, we talked in the predecessor episode of this about John Paul Jones. I think it was in the prior episode to this. No, that wasn't a Confederation Arrest. That was the wrong show. So over on the Kicked in the Dice Bags, we were talking about how John Paul Jones is a completely overpowered NPC.
Yes.
But I can't remember which podcast I was on. Let's do Zero to Published again. Chris, I'm becoming your age. Good God, is this what you've been living with?
Yeah, basically this is how it goes, man. And then there's a nice comfort to the fact, and that a lot of times, you know how we always make the joke about how old people just frankly don't give a shit anymore, so that's why they'll fart in rooms filled with people, because you know what, they've done their time, they don't care, they don't need to have manners. You start,
who are they trying to impress?
Exactly. I'm 80 f-ing years old. If I want to fart, I'm gonna fart, and if you don't like it, leave. Yeah. I'm too old to move that fast.
What, are you not going to impress the girl so you don't get laid tonight?
That's right.
Guess what doesn't work anymore?
Yeah. It was interesting on I think one of the cruises Carl and I were on, I think the source occurred. We sat down and I don't remember. I can't remember where this was either. It was anywhere I want it to be. I'm too old to remember.
But
that's the other nice thing about it.
Embrace it.
You can just make that shit up, man.
We were talking to some old people, and they really kind of put life in perspective of how little all the day-to-day drama you stress about when you're 15 or 25 or even 35, how little all that really matters in the sum of your life.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you know, how much it really adds up to in the end is basically nothing. The things that you're stressing over by the time that you're 10 years away from, they don't even matter anymore. And they really gave me some perspective on that. But anyway, so over on Kicked in the Dice Bags, I was talking about how John Paul Jones was apparently being played by a Phil-type player. If you don't know who John Paul Jones is, pause the podcast, go hit Wikipedia and look him up. He's a really fascinating historical figure.
Not the guitarist from Zeppelin.
Right. No, not him. But the point is that even while he was sailing to England on his one-man bender of violence, which just so happened to work out against all the odds for some weird reason, do you know how long it takes to sail from America to England?
3 months.
Yeah, it's months. This guy was not fighting battles every day of his life. Most of what he's doing is waking up, talking to the navigator, who knows what. I mean, these days.
Getting scurvy. He was battling scurvy every day of his life. That's what he was doing.
Yeah, not like the same way that, like, epic. The Crest kids battle.
If you've ever had scurvy, that is an epic battle.
Yes.
You don't want to lose.
But it wasn't being fought in the way that, like, the Crest kids fight the tooth decay monsters.
That's true.
We make holes in teeth.
Wow. I was going to say, damn.
I'll have to link that one on the podcast for anyone that's...
I remember the Crest Kids.
Yeah, I do too, and I shouldn't. I'm suddenly, I don't know. But text posted something the other day that I did not need to hear. He posts like, do you realize that Ralph Macchio is now the same age that Pat Morita was when The Karate Kid was made?
That's right.
It's like, I did not need to know that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Poor Pat Morita. Rest in peace.
That's right, brother.
But getting back to role-playing games, the point being, though, that that's not the story of the man's life. Those huge battles, the crazy things he did, the high points that we remember. And here was a man who was caught up in a world-changing event. I'm not sure he himself changed the world, per se, but he was caught up in what became a world-changing event, you know, the birth of America.
Mm-hmm.
But this man's life consisted of these stories on a day-to-day basis that made him who he was. If there was somebody sitting in this room right now, I mean, other than Chris, who actually was old enough to remember the guy, I'm not sure what they would remember about him is going to be the major battles he fought. It's going to be something about who he was or what he did or how he lived his life or the types of jokes he cracked that is probably lost to history.
He always picked up the tab.
provided it was high in vitamin C.
Now that is an epic hero in my book, the guy who always picks up the tab, worthy of praise and songs being sung about him.
Chad, I think the same thing about that sci-fi game that we played some years back, the one that we talked about a few episodes back where mine was the only character that survived. Mm-hmm. It was the same thing. That was absolutely a story about three or four people changing the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a Star Wars type story in terms of a handful only of people doing these really unlikely events, but it was still very character driven. I mean, we spent entire sessions where nothing occurred beyond role playing these guys sitting around tables talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people say, holy crap, that's so boring, but it wasn't. I can see
where... Is General Hospital boring? No, that's a bunch of people epically talking to each other all the time.
That's character development, like I was talking about. Yeah. You know, it's the character growth for those characters.
Actually, I think that's where you can draw the line. All my games are just a whole bunch of people talking to each other back and forth, and not much happens. It's kind of like a soap opera. Well, here's how you tell if it's good or not. It's good if there is character development. Then that's a story. That's a drama. If it is character masturbation, where you're just taking the tropes of the character and you're just kind of working them over and over and over and over and over again, that's a soap opera. You're throwing them in melodramatic situations. That's not good. I think that's important, is that you want the characters to advance. You want them to move. You want them to grow. You want them to change. You want them to be affected by the events around them in ways that you don't necessarily expect them to be.
Well, and something that I found is when the game is set up right, the scale of the game really doesn't matter as much. And if a game master understands that, that's a very liberating idea,
mm-hmm.
because you can suddenly step back and tell any number of stories.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to tell stories that are either at the large scale or at the small scale or at the mid scale, whether in the foreground or background. Those sliders suddenly don't matter. And it becomes very, very liberating. Because as a game master, you can come in on a game day and know, look, as long as I've got something interesting occurring here, these people are invested in their characters, they're invested in the universe, and therefore they are going to probably enjoy this game. And if I want to tell a story that's big or small, and it's big in the foreground or big in the background or small in the foreground or small, it doesn't matter. But once again, Chad, that D&D game, you told stories. I say you told. I mean, you're a very clever person. You were not
stories
giving
were
us
told.
Plot exposition. Yeah, this was not.
You jump on my tracks.
Yeah, and I've had those game masters. That's not what you were doing. But there were games where you came in and the plot that we were going through was changing the balance of power.
Mm-hmm.
And those were interesting games. There were other plots where we spent entire game sessions trying to keep the spirits of an orphanage and its caretakers up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we were doing. And that was also interesting. And you as a game master could tell both of those stories in the same space because of the fact that
the characters were solid.
The characters were solid. Yeah. The setting was solid. The narrative overall was solid. Mm-hmm. And that gave you that freedom in there to really tell almost any kind of story you wanted to tell. And I'll tell you, as a game master, trying to figure out how to break and then save the universe again and again and again, is hard.
Yeah.
I was talking to some people on Facebook today about some of my issues with Mass Effect 3, and there are people I'm friends with who jumped in on it, booters who jumped in on it. I had to, both on Facebook and Google Plus, over on Google Plus side, Ryan Dancy jumped in on it. And one of the things that we kind of seem to have consensus over was that the difficulty of the story of Mass Effect 3 was when you present a story that is that intricate and that epic, it is very, very hard to give it a satisfying ending. Because you have what I call the nuclear panic button, which is, we've made something huge, we have no idea how you defeat it, but if we can put a nuke in the right spot, the whole thing's gone.
Right.
Independence Day did that. Transformers did that with the Matrix of Leadership. Michael Bay's done that in Transformers.
Every movie he does.
The Trench Run. You know, the Death Star, there's no way you can possibly defeat this thing, but it just so happens to be if you shoot a missile down one little hole, its reactor, which apparently has no fail safes, goes up and takes out this planet-sized object.
It's a really dangerous
one. Put a screen over that. Maybe just a screen. Well, that depends. Is money a no option?
Oh, get some bids.
Let's get some bids.
Get some bids. But your other option is you don't really wrap it up at all.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying these are the only two options. I mean, there are other ways of wrapping this up. But the point being that when you create these kinds of enemies that are huge, that are way out of your league, the universe is falling apart around you, and you have to come up with a convincing way that half a dozen people can change that. Yes, you can tell that story and you can tell it well. And you can, I think, even tell it well while sticking to pretty well established tropes, provided you're adding the right amount of depth and intrigue and whatever that your players want out of that. But the point being that it becomes very, very hard to tell that story again and again and again in a compelling way. How many different ways are there to defeat Unicron before you've kind of seen them all?
Yep.
You blew him up. You talked him out of it. You got him stuck in the negative zone. Okay, we're pretty much out of options.
Oh, my God. Unicron versus Superman. Stick him in the negative zone.
That's true. That's the answer to everything.
It is. Is that anal?
And on that note, I think consideration that you want to think about in this too is how long do you want this game to go on? Because this is something we've always talked about in Fear the Boot, because I come from a background of playing long running campaigns, whereas a lot of other people come from playing very short duration, you know, something 6 months to a year tops, and that's long to them. So, yes, if you as a GM or a group, if you as a GM want to tell a long story, if you want to run a campaign where you don't really see it ending, you want just for it to go on, stay away from ultra epic. That's my advice, because like you're saying, Dan, once you've saved the kingdom, what's next? You save the planet. What's the after
universe,
that? Then you
the
have to
multi universe.
Then you,
the galaxy, the
then you have
galaxy.
To develop. Then your fantasy campaign has to develop space travel so they can save other planets. I mean, it's just this
and
ratcheting
then
we'll thing.
Shrink down to the atomic level. We'll save all
exactly.
the atomic
Ant-Man.
Level people. And
but on the other hand, though, if you want to run a campaign that's got a 6 month arc to it, go for it. If you like epic, there you go. I think it's just. Consider what you're doing. Consider what you want to do or what your players want to do. Talk to them. Like you say, talk to them and say, do we want to play for a long time or do we want to play a big epic game that's and from the get go, we'll do it. And when we get to the end of it, we're going to play something else because what are you going to do after that? Because we've sort of done the big thing.
Yeah. And I hope that's really the takeaway people get from this episode is not that epic is bad.
No,
it's just that epic is only
it has
option.
Its place.
Right.
And
use it wisely.
It's one that I think I have fallen on too readily and not really given, I think, a fair shake to the small and mid-sized stories that can be told either within the context of an epic story or even all by their lonesome out on their own.
What I think is interesting is very often, and we have illustrated on this episode and many others, most of the time I think the players are going to remember those small stories, those small elements. What's one of the stories that we hear most often on this?
Wayne's frying pan.
Okay, what story do we wish we'd hear more often of?
You will continually go back to Gnarl and telling some of the smaller stories that happened because those are the most memorable.
Yeah.
Not, the epic is, it was there, it was memorable, but when you really get down to it, the things that you remember,
there was a time,
the small things, these little intimate moments.
There was a point in history where I had a document running that had the exact size of his tribe, the resources of his tribe, a loose diagram of the fortress they were trying to put together. Chad had told me kind of what my growth rate was going to be based on some roles that I had, thank you, Dice Gods, knocked out of the park 2019-20, as best as I recall. I couldn't tell you that stuff now.
Right.
I really don't recall most of it. I could tell you little bits and pieces of it, mm-hmm. but I don't recall it. I recall a lot more about those small stories mm-hmm. than I do about the empire he was attempting to build. I know he was attempting to build one. I remember some of it, but the point being that that's not really what I walk away with, because yeah. that's not the first role-playing game I've played in where I had a character who was working to build an empire. I don't think I've played one since, but I'm sure eventually I will. But that was the only time that I played him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what I walk away with remembering. I think I've kind of got this one where I wanted to get it. And maybe there's other angles to look at the scale of a story in terms of execution, kind of the different difficulties and opportunities each one presents. So maybe we'll come back to this in a later episode. But I think really what I wanted to get on this episode, we've gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
So we will catch you next time.
See ya.
The Negative Zone.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.